Good morning, everyone. It's approximately 9 a.m. on Tuesday, September 17th, 2013. This is the date and time scheduled for the meeting of the Utah State Tax Commission. I'm Commissioner Bruce Johnson. With me is Commissioner Darcy Dixon Pignanelli, Commissioner Michael Cragen, Commissioner Robert Pirro, our Executive Director, Barry Conover. And taking the minutes at this proceeding is Krista Johnson, our Executive Assistant. The next order of business is public comment. I don't see any members from the public. So we'll proceed to the third item on the agenda, which is to consider approving the open and closed commission meeting minutes of August 22nd, 2013.
Bill, Mr. Chair, this is Commissioner Dixon. I'm not seeing closed minutes. Is it just open?
Well,
special commission meeting minutes. We had to hold a special meeting to send our budget items up to the governor's office. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if it would be okay, I'd like to request that we hold these minutes. There's an item on there that I'd like to take a look at, and I'd like to request that we hold them.
Okay, we'll hold those over to the next meeting then.
Thank you.
I was reading from the minutes of the last meeting. It does say special commission meetings on our agenda, so I apologize.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like you developed a cold.
Well, it's those people from Hawaii.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
All right, the next item on the agenda is to approve submission of proposed rule amendments to the Division of Administrative Rules. Commissioner Pirro.
Commissioner Dixon, who chairs the Farmland Advisory Committee, is going to go ahead and handle the R884-24P-53, the Farmland Assessment Act. Commissioner?
Yes. Let's see. Mr. Chairman, the first thing I want to put into the public record right now is that through no fault of really anyone's, the report that I think my fellow commissioners received is not the revised report. And I think this was just a confluence of us trying to participate in WSSADA and be available to be at that convention, and then the activities that had to take place during that same time period. So what I'm going to do is explain the differences from the report that you have and that you see, and that will have no influence on the rule, but I'm going to explain to you why we had to have a revised report, okay? So before I get into that part, I'm going to just put into the public record the importance of this farmland report to which I'm referring. There is some statutory rules and language and rules. The first one is Utah Code Annotated 59-2-514, which is the State Farmland Evaluation Advisory Committee. And I'm just going to read this. There is created a State Farmland Evaluation Advisory Committee consisting of 5 members appointed as follows. 1 member appointed by the commission who shall be chairman of the committee. I am chair of that committee appointed by our commission chair, Bruce Johnson. 1 member appointed by the president of Utah State University. The current member serving in that position is Dr. Don Snyder, appointed by the president of Utah University. 1 member appointed by the State Department of Agriculture and Food. That's the Deputy Commissioner of Agriculture and Food, Kyle Stevens. 1 member appointed by the State County Assessors Association. At this time, that's Assessor Grave Garf, from Duchesne County, and one member actively engaged in farming or ranching appointed by the other members of the committee. We have appointed Rex Larson, who is a farmer and rancher, and he currently serves in that position. The committee shall meet at the call of the chairman to review the several classifications of land in agricultural use in the various areas of the state and recommend a range of values for each of the classifications based upon productive capabilities of the land when devoted to agricultural uses. And it reads, the recommendation shall be submitted to the commission prior to October 2nd of each year. That is an advisory date, but the committee did meet on October 2nd. So the reason that's important is under the federal, the Farmland Assessment Act, FAA, Farmland Assessment Act, the policymakers of this state have recognized that if farm and ranching land were valued at its highest and best use, that might be commercial, that might be tract land for residential, it would make the land value so high that the taxes on that would almost be prohibitive to those using it in farming and ranching. So the policymakers of this state adopted these farmland agricultural assessment methodologies to value the land in its productive capabilities based upon its uses. And that's the way of understanding this when it says land in agricultural use in the various areas of state, so based upon classifications. So that's where this farmland report comes in. This farmland report is prepared by Utah State University. It's an independent body that does an independent review of land and its uses and its productive capabilities across the state of Utah. So if you were to turn to page 2 of the draft that you received and look at the executive summary, you're going to see these different areas of land. So there's irrigated crop land, there's orchard crop land, there's meadow crop land, there's dry crop land, there's grazing land, and there's non-productive land. And over the years, in the last 4 years, we've developed this executive summary because it just gives a quick picture of what is it they're really trying to do in this farmland report. So for each of those different types, the irrigated, the orchard, the meadow, the dry, the grazing, and the non-productive, there are budgets developed by Utah State University for each one of those. And they're very detailed budgets. And they collect a variety of data in the years on those different crop plants. So one of them is the National Agricultural Statistical Services Producer Prices Paid. They collect information from the United States Department of Agriculture. They're constantly collecting data and information and inputting them into different budgets that they had and spreadsheets that they've developed over the years so that they can look at what is the potential for productivity on these types of land when used in that use, whether it's irrigated or orchard or meadow. So one of the other items I'd like to bring to your attention, if you can just keep turning the page really quickly, I'm going to take you down to Okay, if you could turn to page 11, please. Okay, page 11, and we're going to look at figure 1. Okay, and the other thing that's really important about this is that the values that the Farmland Committee is going to recommend to you today that's in the proposed rule is based on a 5-year average, and this chart shows that to you. So I'm going to try to explain this, but this report will be made public, so it will be on our website so the public can view this as well. I realize you're looking at it in black and white, but if we're trying to capture a 5-year average rate, because what that does is it stabilizes the changes. Because if you did it on a fixed rate, for example, or a variable rate, it makes the downs and ups of these values of the lands more extreme. And so the 5-year average fixed rate, as you see, is a little bit, even though there's some ups and downs in it, it's a little less peaks and valleys. And so the way that's done is that there's a 5-year average, and I'm going to take you back to a chart. I know this is hanging there with me. If you can now go back to page 7 and look at table 1. It says on the top of it, average prices received Utah 2007 to 2012. So it's got 2007, 08, 09, 010, 11, 012. So last year's values, the ones that we adopted at this time last year, were based on a 5-year average of 2007 to 2011. This year, we add 2012 and drop 2007. Okay, so this is just looking at prices. So because, let's just look at alfalfa. Because the cost, the price per ton in 2007 for alfalfa was $129, but in 2012, the price per ton was $189. When we drop 129 and we add 189, the percent change goes up by 2%. Okay, so the other thing this chart shows is that someone's going to say, but it's 2013 and we're adopting values for 2014. Why are we using 2012? That's because that's the year in which we have the most data. So Utah State University uses the data for 2012. So technically, we really are 2 years behind the values for the year for which we're looking at. We add a year for 2012. We adopt those values in 2013, and they are valid for January 1, 2014. Now, someone else would look at that and say, okay, so for alfalfa, barley, corn, grain, cord silage, oats, safflower, wheat, and onions, it looks for the majority of those, the percent change has gone up. Then, what has that done to the overall values then? The place that you start to see where this becomes an impact is if you turn over to the very next page on page 8 and look at table 3. When developing these budgets, they look at the prices, they look at the cost data, they look at the crop mix, and they look at, I'm going to blank on the other one, but I will come right back to it. So even though the prices for 2012 percent change went up, the other thing that went up were the costs. The cost to the farmers and the ranchers in the most part went up. Fertilizer may have gone down, but chemicals went up. The machinery costs went up. Seed, feed, herbicide, insecticide. And what you're going to see, if you look at that very next sentence down, the overall total average cost increase for all production inputs for Utah's typical crops was approximately 6.2%. So the consumer price index only went up 1.7%, but the overall cost went up by 6.2%. So And then the last data point is the other inputs that can affect these costs and prices. So that's why when you look at the overall recommendations in the farmland report for irrigated crop land, the values overall went down. For orchard crop land, the overall values declined fairly evenly across the state. For meadow crop land, this was where the largest suggested land values decreased. And this is where I want to show you, if you'll go back to the executive summary, that there was an error in this. In your draft, it says -4 per acre. That is actually -5 per acre. And so that is shown correctly in the revised farmland report. But it went down even more. The dry land crop went down. The grazing land went down, and the non-productive land really had no change in value. So the last chart on which I'd like to draw to your attention is if you'll go to page 16. These are trying to look at something here really quickly, if you'll give me a minute. These are the values that are in the proposed rule before you today. And you'll see at the top those different productive uses: irrigated, orchard, meadow, grazing, dry farm, and non-productive. You'll see it for each county on the left-hand side. And the only thing I'm seeing before you as I'm looking at it is these are the correct values that are in the proposed rule. So it must be that only that -4 to -5 that wasn't correct in the report before you. So these are the values that are in the draft rule before you. And there was one other very interesting question that was asked at our farmland committee meeting. And those minutes are recorded, and they are up and on our website. You'll see that under irrigated, it says 1, 2, 3, and 4. Those are the different types of land in those different uses. And I want to note that Denny Lytle, our director of the Property Tax Division, is in the room today, as well as Craig Jolly, who is our assistant director of the Property Tax Division. And they explained that those different classes are an intense look at the different types of land that the Property Tax Division does. They put together standards of practice that they provide the assessors, and a lot of those are done on soil studies. So if land has a certain soil depth without rocks, or if it has more sand in it, it's a very intense process that they go through. So what I want to make clear in the record is these are not values that are just pulled out of the air. There's intense studies, intense budgets. They have an independent review. The Property Tax Division reviews them. They have a lot of eyes looking to make sure that we are getting good values for this farmland, that we as and grazing land, that we as commissioners can feel comfortable adopting into our rule. So the only other thing I'd like to add is that the Farmland Committee met on Wednesday, October 2nd. we went through all of this. It was at that time that it was determined that there were some cut and paste errors through no fault of anyone's. There was just a lot of budgets and there were kind of some cut and paste errors. I want to thank Craig Jolly, who, again, our property tax division takes these seriously. He went through each number. He pulls them out every year and looks at each number and compares them back and forth. He found the cut and paste error. Because of that, the Farmland Committee decided that they needed to meet again and look at a revised report. We did that through an electronic meeting on Monday, and we had a quorum, and we looked at the revised report, we looked at the numbers, and we adopted the revised report. Those revised numbers are the ones that are before you in this Table 8, 2013, and those are the numbers that were put into the proposed rule before you. And it is is put together, the tables are put together by our property tax division, and they get it over to Lynn Solarzik, who oversees our rules, and she puts it into the rule format that goes to our fellow commissioner, Robert Pirro, who then takes another look at it. And finally, I'd like to thank our fellow commissioner, Robert Pirro. He did come to our farmland meeting on October 2nd, and that will be my last year of chairing the Farmland Committee. Mr. Chair, I've really enjoyed chairing that these last 4 years. I have learned a lot. And really enjoyed those committee members. The committee only meets once a year, but their role is very important. And they're good committee members, and our Property Tax Division does a great job overseeing a lot of those things with the farmland. And I know Commissioner Pirro will enjoy it very much. So with that, I'm open to answer any questions you might have. You might have questions from the Property Tax Division as well.
Okay, are there any questions for Commissioner Dixon? Anything the Property Tax Division would like to add? Well, thank you for a very thorough report, and thank you for your service on that, as chair of that committee for the last 4 years. Would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I would. Thank you. I would recommend, I am not seeing. I would like to move that we adopt rule R884. We're not adopting. I'm sorry. Can I revise that? I would like to move that we approve submission of the proposed rule amendment to R884-24P-53, 2014 Valuation Guides for Valuation of Land Subject to the Farmland Assessment Act.
Any discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 That motion passes unanimously.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a small little tidbit that was somewhat interesting that came out of the meeting, it doesn't have anything to do with the rule, but there in 2012, usually it's Michigan that is the largest producer, seller of the commodity of tart cherries. But because of an unusual freeze in Michigan, Utah became the highest producing state and selling state of tart cherries in the nation. Oh. So let that be known that we have a commodity that in unusual times becomes the largest user in the nation, and I thought that was a fun item. The only other item I would put on it is that our farmland report does become something that is very important to the farmers and ranchers because they want to understand how these budgets are derived and used. And so for our upcoming assessors meeting, what I did last year and I'll be doing again this year is I take a copy of the executive summary and just copy it back to back and take it to our assessor's school and give a copy of it to the assessors to kind of post in their offices. So if any farmer or rancher comes in and says, I'm just trying to understand, I'm coming in to pay my taxes and I don't understand how these values were derived, there's something there for the assessors to give these members of our community. And also at the meeting, it was stated that the Farmland Bureau would work with our property tax division to maybe develop a flyer that could go to different group organizations, the Farmland Bureau, the Wool Growers Association, the Utah Cattlemen's Association, the Conservation Districts, and that would help them understand these budgets, this process, so that everyone has a better understanding, a better education of how these values are determined. So I want to appreciate the Property Tax Division for doing that.
Let me ask our parliamentarian a question. Well, let me ask you first. Would it be helpful or appropriate for us to formally adopt the report?
Do you know, that would be good, but I don't see it as an action item on here.
That was going to be my next question for our parliamentarian, Commissioner Cragen, if that could be deemed to be within the ambit of item four or not, where we could do that at a subsequent meeting.
Technically, the farmland report has been adopted by the farmland committee, and then the values in the report have been recommended to the tax commission as a whole. So I will be happy. Okay, I'd be happy to defer to some comments on that from our fellow commissioner as well.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your interest in the report.
Commissioner Pirro, Rule 884-24P-29.
Yes, we have this this other rule that we need to submit to the Hill. This is for taxable household furnishings. The proposed amendment clarifies that household furnishings, furniture, and equipment that meet the definition of qualifying exempt primary residential rental personal property under Section 59-2-102 qualify for the primary residential exemption and are valued for property tax purposes by calculating the value of the personal property using the tables in Tax Commission Rule R884-24P-33 and multiplying that value by 0.55.
Any questions for Commissioner Pirro on that? That rule was necessary because of a statutory change. I understand that extended that exemption to personal property that was not owned by the person of the residential, who was occupying the residential unit, so the tenants can get the benefit of that. Hopefully we'll get the benefit of that exemption being passed through to them in lower rents. Would you like to make a motion?
I would. So I'd like to make a motion that we approve for submittal. R884-24P-29.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Rule that motion passes unanimously. Item number five, the internal audit analysis of payments and returns. Commissioner Dixon?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Coming to the table here to address us today is our Director of Internal Audit, Amon Kadia. And we have two items on the agenda today. The first one is acceptance of internal audit analysis of processing of payments and returns during income tax season 2013. And so I'm just going to note that we also have in the audience today Andrew Hildebrandt, who's a member of our internal audit unit as well. So I'm going to turn the time over to Mr. Cadilla. Do you just want to give a general?
Good morning, everybody. This is the report about how fast we are processing our tax returns and how quickly we are depositing payment checks during the income tax season. We've been doing this audit for quite a few years. There was a gap between 2004 and 11, and during that time, things didn't work out the way they were working before that, so we did that audit, and ever since then, the timing to deposit checks or the timing to process refunds has kind of improved significantly. And I guess the Taxpayer Service Division has, Processing Division, I'm sorry, has done a remarkable job in taking care of those items during the busy income tax season. There are no recommendations. They have been using that rip and sort technique for the last 2-3 years again, and that has significantly improved the in calendar days to deposit the payment checks. One item I would like to address is that these checks, most of these taxpayers, they file their return, even if they are paid returns, but they pay their taxes due on the due date. And that, you know, brings an influx of quite a number of payment checks. Although they say that 80% or 70% of tax returns have been e-filed, but the payments in most cases have not been made. But with the introduction of rip and sort technique, they have improved that. Although people say that the interest rates are very low, so what advantage it is to use that rip and sort? Well, our position is that the government needs money as soon as possible. And if the money is not deposited on time, then it affects the budget. So besides, you know, not getting enough interest, but at least we are depositing the money on time, and that enables the government to formulate the budget more realistically. I mean, they're doing it, this rip and sorting and technique, and improve it. We'll think about it, that should we continue this audit for the next year or so. It depend on the executive director's suggestion or the commission. Because I guess the lowest we have is now 2.6 days it takes, calendar days, to deposit the checks, and you cannot get any better unless you put more resources, but then it would affect the other functions of the tax commission. So that's all I have to say about this audit. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Amon?
No, I see Mr. Carroll Conover is looking to speak.
Yes, Barry Conover. I appreciate the audit. We have it every year, and I think it has to be judicious because under the Money Management Act, it gives us 3 days to get the money into the bank. We're at 2.6, and knowing our staff in that division, that they will exceed that, but putting more resources doing rip and sort from other divisions is probably not beneficial to the state nor to the agency, but I certainly do appreciate the audit that Amon has
Thank
presented
you.
Today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Dixon?
Yes. And I know Mr. Cadilla said this. It sounds like we're all getting things in our throat. I'm starting to lose my voice, too. And I can hear Mr. Cadilla is kind of low on a voice as well. It must be going through all of us. It cannot be overemphasized enough that it takes it takes two to tango, and the processing division has to, and any division that's undergoing an internal audit has to be a willing participant and cooperate. These are kind of silent workers down there in our property tax division. I hate to say it, but down there in that warehouse, there are not a lot of people that we see come and going unless we walk through the lunchroom. But they're always pleasant to our internal auditors. They're always helpful. And we just thank not only the directors of the division, but just the employees that are always nice when
they're
our internal
excellent.
Auditors
they're
go
excellent.
Down there.
Yeah.
So with that, I would move acceptance of the internal audit analysis of processing of payments and returns during the income tax season 2013. And Mr. Chairman B, if I could just say one other item on that. I think one of the items that we determine is Mr. Cadilla has brought up, should we continue this from year to year? A lot of times that depends on what our internal audit plan is for the upcoming year, whether we get unusual audits that we need to look at, whether we have ones that are going to take more time to do those audits. We're not at the staffing levels we were before the Great Recession, and so we're trying to do what we can, and we have to reach those high-risk areas. This is important, as was brought to the attention of everyone, because you want to get them processed and deposited as quick as possible, because that's interest and that's revenues that run the rest of the functions of the state. But I think we as a commission can take recommendation from our executive director, Barry Conover, from internal audit, and from looking at our audit plan and decide what we need to do going
yes,
forward
that's
on that.
True.
Okay. And we will have an internal audit plan that will be coming up to us by the 1st of December. We
yes,
need to look
I'm...
at that.
Every year around, thank you very much, Commissioner Dixon. Every year around November, we send an email to all the division directors asking them if they want us to take a look at some of their functions or what kind of help they would like from us. And no exception, it will go again this year. And if the executive director or the division directors, if they feel that we should be doing it, you're most welcome. We'll do it and we'll accommodate this audit.
Thank you. We appreciate that communication and that opportunity, because I think as a division, we see some things that maybe we need to have another set of eyes look at. And I appreciate the willingness of the internal auditor to do that.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, just before we voted, I just wanted to put that out there. So again, I move acceptance of the internal audit analysis of processing of payments and returns during income tax season 2013.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That motion is approved unanimously.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner Dixon, do you want to address the policy
yes.
on
once a year we get this, don't we? Yes, we have started a process, and I'll have our internal auditor look a little bit more at that, but we've reached a digital age of life where we're all we're working off of computers, and I see a lot of them up today on the dais where we're sitting as commissioners. Everyone's got iPads up, and looking at them, and we've got a digital form where we're keeping things on clouds and things like that. We're trying to preserve material in a more efficient way. We're also trying to preserve material so that it's maybe more easily accessible. In many respects, we're also trying to preserve material so that it's in a format that doesn't decay, so that 10 years down the road, someone can go back and look at it and say, okay, how did we get to that point? And so we've reached a time where, though we have boxes and boxes here at the State Tax Commission and also at archives of audit papers and reports and work papers like that, we've reached a point where we need to start digitizing those and preserving those in a more efficient manner. And that's what's before you today, is that again, this is one of those things where you want to make sure that you're doing it in a consistent manner, that everyone understands how you're doing it, and that it's really understood that that's in a way that's going to work to preserve it for years down the road. So that's why there's a policy on digitization of internal audit work papers and reports before you today. One, to let you know that we're doing it. Two, so that you understand how that's going to be done, because these are important work papers. And three, to get input, because somebody might have a thought or idea on that. And fourth, even though these policies are adopted, they can always be reviewed and updated. And so the Internal Audit Division's been working on this, and I'm just going to turn over to Aman Kadia, our Director of Internal Audit, to add in any further information.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Dixon. Let me give you a little brief background. For the last several years, we've been looking at those boxes in our storage unit and audit work papers, audit reports. Some were 15, some were 20 years old, and they were just staying there. The grandma policy says that we should keep the records up to 10 years, and beyond that 10 years, they should be destroyed. So my assistant, Andrew, and I just went through those boxes. We had about 80 plus boxes in that storage unit. And we went through all those boxes, mostly by Andrew, and eliminated 47 boxes, which had, you know, audit work papers and audit reports 10 years and beyond. And then I started thinking that why do we need so much paper? And as Commissioner Dixon says, they decay and they get old. We have work papers on 3.5-inch diskettes. We have work papers on 5.25-inch diskettes. And those are just ancient, you know. Can't even read them. I mean, we found few diskettes, and I had to scour around to get if I could get a portable 3.5-inch disk reader to see what the document is there, what kind of documents, work papers there. So then I researched around. Most of these audit shops are now digitizing their work papers, their audits, and everything. And as Commissioner Dixon said, that we are coming to the age of, you know, electronics. Another thing is that if you look at, there is more and more emphasis towards continuous auditing and auditing 100% of the transactions. 2 years ago, I went to a training seminar where it was, the instructor was from Disney World, and the techniques and the things he said were just mind-boggling, and I thought we are almost, you know, 20 years behind. And with most of the data is now kept electronically, and it could be accessed, and you can audit or review 100% of it, then you can form a better opinion on the audit and provide a better conclusion. So we decided that let's go digital. So with this little background, we started, you know, looking into it. And the first thing I said that we need a policy. We need a procedure which is in compliance with the grammar, with the state, so we are not in, you know, conflict with those. And based on that, we have developed this policy, this procedure. It has lots of kinks in there, but this is the first step we are taking towards it. And I would appreciate the commission and the executive director and all that, they would help us in identifying that which document and how it should be approached to preserve the confidentiality, to preserve the reliability, and also the longevity, you know, of that report. Last year, a year ago, we did an audit on the security of access control with our new Gentech system. There were reams and reams of, you know, papers in Excel worksheets that who has what access. You cannot just review all those papers and form an opinion. And even if you take a sample of that and audit them, it might not be a good decision. So we are using an audit software called ACL, or Audit Command Language, to analyze But the files are huge. And if they are kept, you know, in a digital format, and if all the referencing, all the work papers, all the audit reports are kept in a digital reference, in a digital mode, we will be able to formulate a better opinion, a more accurate opinion, and this data would be available for a long time. So based on that, we have, you know, started this project. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions for Mr. Cadillo?
Just have a question for Commissioner Dixon. Mr. Cadillo provided us an advanced copy of the proposed policy, and I went through that and identified several recommended changes. They're all stylistic, consistency, filling in gaps, those kinds of suggested changes. They don't affect the policy that's proposed or anything like that. I just wanted to get a sense of how you feel about moving forward with the proposal in light of the suggested changes I've made. I'm not opposed to adopting it and then making revisions later. I wanted to just find out how you feel about it.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Again, I appreciate everyone's thorough review of it, and as I said before, that's why the policy's out there, so everyone can give their input on it. At this point, as you said, they were ideas of how to make sure that they were the wording was consistent in there, and I would recommend to my fellow commissioners that maybe we go ahead and adopt the policy with the recommended changes that were given by Commissioner Cragen, because I think they're just, again, they're kind of stylistic consistency items, and I don't think they affect.
There were also some changes recommended by Commission Chair, you know.
I'm sorry, I missed that too.
I mean, but I haven't incorporated any of those because I didn't have enough time.
Yeah. One of them is purely stylistic. The other one, I think, actually will probably need
security.
Probably need to think about a little bit.
Okay, then
so
let's
I
do
would,
this.
I
I was not aware that you'd made a recommendation
just
on that.
Just happened before nine humans.
Okay, okay,
but
and
I would
again,
be very comfortable adopting it with the stylistic changes proposed, recognizing that there's no change in the substance of the procedure. And then it's not a big mystery. I mean, Mr. Cudillo suggested that the digitized documents be kept basically on the system.
Server drive.
And on a thumb drive. And I just said, I think we probably need more development of how we're going to keep those thumb drives or flash
right.
drives secure, because you know, that's a concern that those things can
very easy to
easy.
Steal.
So I just suggested that there be more development at that point, but I don't think we need to delay this pending development of that
Kay.
Idea.
Again, to that point, Mr. Chairman, as I said in the opening, it a policy is somewhat of a living document. As you want to update it and make changes to it, you can come back and do a revised policy on that. And that's what I would recommend on that, because as you indicated, as technology changes and things move on, we have to constantly be reviewing these policies on that. So Mr. Cadillo could continue to look at that. We can take some input and come back and do a revised policy. But I would appreciate it if we as a commission could move forward and approve this.
Mr. Chairman, I agree. With the policy, there is a statewide policy on thumb drives that has come out by DTS. We have adopted that policy. That policy is that all those thumb drives have to be owned by the agency, have to be encrypted, hardware encrypted, and that they have to be inventoried. And we already have a policy, so we can integrate the statewide policy
Wonderful.
With the agency policy as far as the security
that.
Aspects of it is concerned, because that is a critical issue. We've had to recall all of our previous thumb drives from all of our different agents divisions and reissue new encrypted thumb drives. They're a kangaroo drive that we have out there. We have plenty of them. And so as you start looking at going into this thumb drive archival.
We've got two with a blank, you know, right?
Yeah, we need to replace those if, and have them under inventory control. And that control begins with purchasing, goes into our security officer, Bobette Phillips, and she keeps a control. Those are then assigned to, for this example, to Amon, and then Amon would keep that inventory and we would audit against that from a security perspective, that encrypted thumb drive.
So should I get in touch with Bobette about
it? Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you.
But it doesn't preclude anything that we're doing on your policy.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to an amendment in the near future that will specifically incorporate those procedures in this procedure as well.
Mr. Chairman, I again, that's the purpose of these public meetings, is sometimes to have that dialogue and to let the public know that we take these items seriously, the security, the review, and I think that's noted that our executive director, Mr. Conover, heads up a committee for the state of Utah on security, and so we have the ability to, even more so, to make sure that we're staying on top of those ever-increasing changes in the digital and security world. And so we welcome the chance to dialogue on that and come back with an amendment.
Thank you.
Okay. So again, with that, I would move acceptance of Office of the Commission policy on digitization of internal audit work papers and reports.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Thank you very much.
Thank you. That report or policy is accepted and adopted. Mr. Conover, Executive Director's Report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. It's good to be here. We have some things to report today. First of all, I think we had a very successful WSSADA conference here at the state of Utah, working in concert with the state of Hawaii. The topics were on point. It was disappointing that the Internal Revenue Service couldn't be a part of that because of the shutdown, but from the discussions and sidebar conversations that I was able to have with other states and the participants, it was very well received, and the attendance was excellent, and I would again compliment Krista and Karen and Charlie for doing exceptional work and making sure all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed. I think the folks were not only impressed with our governor and when he spoke, but the way that we handle the conference here in Utah. And I just want to thank the commission and the folks that have been so intimately involved in that for a successful conference. As you know, this weekend is a big weekend. It's not only a holiday weekend, but it's a Vaders weekend. We are rolling out our Vaders Motor Vehicle Title Registration System and MVED product. Just to kind of give you a little bit of a feel, we have tested over 56,000 test scenarios. It's the largest testing that we've ever done in the agency, and it's probably the largest that any agency has done in the state of Utah, if not nationally. But it's a complicated, big, huge system. We have 55 interfaces that we have to deal with, from law enforcement to counties, to our vendors that do the online with UII. We have 80 data sets that we move on a daily basis, multiple times, not just concurrently, and also sequentially. We'll be converting 2.7 million motor vehicle records and also cases from MVED. We begin 5 o'clock tomorrow evening, Friday evening. We will process for approximately 12 hours the complete MVA process so we can get the latest information into the MVA system before we convert. We then at probably sometime early Saturday morning, we will start the conversion. We will take the MVA records and move them into Vaders. That will take approximately 23 to 24 hours to process the conversion, at which time we will do what we call conversion verification, and that will take up to 4 hours. We have approximately 15 to 20 people coming in, making sure that what we see on the old system, we also see on the VADR system. We're validating, verifying all of the converted data. After that, we have a manual updates where we didn't convert some of the transactions because there wasn't enough to convert. We'll just enter them manually. There's about a 4-hour span there that we will look at. At the conclusion of that, we will back up the system in VADRs, and then we will move it to what we call UTMS, which is the kind of a staging area where we will, what we affectionately call playground. We'll have approximately 30-some-odd people in here going through and testing end-to-end transactions, data that we've kept in abeyance to process through that system to make sure all of the connectivity, all of the applications, the screens, the data is operating properly within VADRs. After we do that, we will go back and delete that. We will bring up the old backed up version, the relatively old but a new backup version of VADRs, bring it online, and then starting Monday morning, we'll be running live data into the system. And we have, I think, 6 counties that have volunteered to come in and at 1 o'clock on Monday afternoon and start doing manual transactions and activities from the branch operations. And all the dealer batches will be, during this weekend, the folks that are doing OTIS, which is on the spot, and those that are doing RECs, that data is being stored at UII. That will all be downloaded on Monday. And so, folks, we have probably 400 and some odd lines of cutover code that we are benchmarking against as we go through step to step. We've been cutting over for the last 3 weeks, holding some transactions and making sure that we have a clean cutoff, a clean conversion, a well-tested new system, and then processing on Monday, which is a holiday, processing active data and then load testing those systems from the counties and other places. So I've been walking around the building this morning saying it's a happy Thursday, it's a great Thursday, it's a day before the great event, and there's a lot of, I won't say nervous, but anxious people. And it's not because they're concerned that the system's not gonna work. The biggest issue is because of the complexity. There might be a little hole, but the nice thing about a COTS product is that if we find a problem, we can reconfigure on the spot. We'll have what we call command rooms or war rooms. One of those will be up on the fourth floor where we have the county support people. We've got developers moving in there next to those county support people. We have another one down here in 1034. And so as things come in next week, and we have desk side support in all of the big offices and also many of the county offices, we'll have people right there to help them. And we expect nothing but success. But it's a 15-month project. It's the largest project we've done under the FAST Enterprises. I just want to give you an update.
The largest.
Thank you.
Well, I know you have extensive checklists, but my question is, have the pizza delivery companies been given advance notice?
Hey, we got them on contract.
A lot of pizza delivered this weekend, I suspect.
There will be that, and it's nice that those people will be coming in because we haven't got time for them to go off to a fast food place or someplace to get lunch. Lunches will be brought in. Dinners will be brought in. So that the people can keep on working.
And the chains we're using to chain those people to their desks are humane, padded?
They are, but they are actually the hardest of metals that we can find, but they can't break them.
Mr. Chairman, I did have a few questions on that.
That's terrific. I'm going to turn the gavel over to you. I have a hearing at 10 that
okay.
I need to go to. But I
before you go, you should speak, shouldn't you, on your chairman report? You've got 1 minute.
Well, I was just going to thank everyone for their support on the WSSADA, particularly Krista, Karen, tremendous job. I probably shouldn't say this, but I know they have jobs in Hawaii if they ever want. month and we got tremendous reviews. I'd like to thank the Property Tax Division for all their help on the farmland assessment. Charlie also on WSSADA. The internal auditors for their great work, and thank Lynn Solarzik for her work on the rules as well. And so with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Commissioner.
All right. I'll close down the meeting well. So we're that just noting for the record that our commission chair Bruce Johnson has excused himself, but we still have a quorum. Mr. Conover, I just wanted to ask you what makes this the largest conversion? And it's really a twofold question. How many years of your life have you been doing this? This is kind of an end of a project for you, the end of an era in a way, a conclusion for you. When did this all start?
We began with a RFP to select a vendor in 2005.
2005.
We awarded the contract to Fast Enterprises. February of 2006, we began our first rollout April 3rd, 2006, 12-month system on income tax. The previous development on income tax, when we did our own development, took us 3 years. We did a complete configuration and implementation and rollout. We rolled out January 16th, 2007, less than 12 months. We got an integrated the first rollout of the system. Since then, we have rolled out all of the taxes. We have all of our miscellaneous taxes, approximately 53 total registration taxes and fees that are integrated on the revenue side into GenTax. And then we had amended the contract in 2011, and we were notified that by the vendor that has Power Builder, which was purchased by SAP, that they would no longer support our motor vehicle product, MVA system. Mm-hmm. And so we are either in a complete rewrite ourselves or going out to the general public, and bidding it out. There wasn't a state out there that had a successful implementation from the other big vendors. Nevada had a failing, Montana had a failing, California had several failings, Arizona had a failing, New Mexico had a failing. In our original RFP, we had mentioned that if we could find a COTS product for a DMV, we would want to look at that. And so we amended the contract. Fast Enterprises agreed to do a motor vehicle system. We in Arkansas are the first to put that up. Arkansas rolled out on the 30th of September. They had a year ago rolled out their driver's license system. Motor vehicle title registration went out this year on the September 30th. We're rolling out on October 15th. So I guess to go back to your question, Commissioner, we've been doing this for almost 8 years.
Wow.
One rollout after another, mm-hmm. after another. Once we complete this one, we will be going into a version upgrade in GenTax, which will be another 6 to 8 month, almost a huge development. There'll be 10 fasties here, plus all our DTS staff, plus business people. We'll be bringing our revenue side up to the same version that we currently have rolling out with motor vehicle. It's web-based, it's highly integrated, it's real time. The nice thing too about this version going out is that the police officers, they get instant data. When we update a record at the DMV, they have that when they want to pull that guy over as he leaves the parking lot.
Really? So it's going to change the whole public safety capability?
Absolutely. They're pinging into our web base, going through our portals. We're going through their portals. Law enforcement statewide will have that. The inlets will have that capability. The VITAS, which is the National Title and Registration product that AAMVA is doing, they have the updates. It's real time, and that's part of the, and it goes back to what Director Amon Tikadia said. We're moving into more technical environment. We are real time cloud technology, what we've done with Google. And so we conclude this one. We have a few weeks before we start doing some what we call pull items, some things that we left out of the system that we'll bring into the system, that were not critical. And then on January, we'll start our version 9 update on the revenue side.
And for the next 6 to 8 months, we'll be doing that. And then after we get through with that one, we should have about 90%. Well, after we roll this out this weekend, we'll have 90% of our processing under one platform, on one platform, Gentex platform, and in the agency. And it's, we're the only agency that has been able to do that.
I appreciate history, and I think sometimes that's the value of these meetings, is to be able to reflect back on some of that history. On a part of that, if I recall correctly, you said the you went out for bid or did the RFP in 2005. I know there were some years of work when you and our former director, Rod Morelli, were up at the legislature full time working to explain to the policymakers up there why there needed to be an investment in this system.
That's
so
correct.
Even before 2005, so
right.
If that whole process started in 2003, I mean, this has been almost a 10-year visionary project to get us to this point.
Yeah, if you take a little of that laying of the ground foundation with our state CIO, Steve Fletcher, and the governors and legislative leadership, yeah, it's been from 2003. And it's been a great ride.
Yeah, well, I wanted to recognize your consistency with
been,
that. I
been
you've stuck with this for 10 years, and we appreciate it on that. So our, just one last question then. Are we going to start to see, are the FAST levels going to stay with the staff here at the same levels for the next year then because of the changing the other elements on that, right? We're going to we're still finishing some projects and we're not going to see a change in the staffing level. Is that correct?
Currently we have, excuse me, currently we have 22 FAST developers on site. By the time, probably in the 1st of November, we'll lose a couple. By the 1st of the year, we'll probably have 5 or 6 down. When we start our conversion update on Gentex, we'll have about 10.
Okay.
And they will be online, those 10 will be online until we complete rollout of the new version. At that point in time, our maintenance and support contracts with FAST will give us 4 FTEs full-time, all the time, here at the Tax Commission. And so we'll have 4, and they may not be the same, they may be rotated in and out with the approval of us, but we will always have a presence of FAST developers here with the cadre of DTS developers. And the nice thing too is what we've been able to accomplish is that with having DMV and tax on the same platform, we've maximized our development and DTS capabilities and maximized our budget, because they're looking at the same applications, the same subsystems, the same language, the same processes. So we have a lot of coverage, and we don't need as many over time. We won't need as many state staff.
So we've gone from a high, we're going to go to 4 on a regular basis. What was the highest amount?
36.
36.
When we rolled out number one with income tax, we had 2 returns. We had to deal with an old return and a new return. Then the next year they went to a dual return, and then they went to a consolidated return. Within 3 years on income tax, we had, I think it was Lynn, 4 or 5 income tax returns that we had to deal with. Under the legacy, we wouldn't have gotten the one out.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, just congratulations, and want to thank you for 10 years of consistent oversight on that
thank
project.
You.
Mr. Connell, we appreciate it very much. Did you have anything else on your director's report? Okay. So fellow commissioners, commissioner reports. Sure? Okay. I know our commission chairman spoke about the Western States Tax Administrator Conference, and our executive director, Mr. Conover, did, but just for the benefit of the public record, it was really the vision of our chairman, Bruce Johnson, who had attended these conventions, who saw that 1 year was supposed to be hosted by Hawaii, but because of the Great Recession, nobody could afford the budget travel to go to Hawaii, and it wasn't a good use of taxpayers' dollars to ask for that during that time, and offered that at a future date that Utah could host WSSADA on behalf of Hawaii. And it was just a great opportunity. One of the benefits of having a conference in your own state is so many more of your staff members can attend because you're not bearing the travel costs. And so I thought it was just a very visionary thing that our chairman did. It gave Hawaii an opportunity. It gave all of us as commissioners an opportunity to attend, a lot of our staff members to attend. Everyone took the opportunity to do that. I know the dialogue in the hallways between a lot of us were, wow, I learned a lot there. That was really insightful. So I know that a lot of credit has gone by our chairman to our staff members who helped pull that off, but I just wanted to make sure that it was also on the record that our chairman had some vision in doing that as well. So thanks to everyone as well and for that, and I know that we look forward to maybe another opportunity that will come back to Utah so we can all have an opportunity to attend again. And did anyone else have anything? I just neglected to say this with the farmland report, but one other person didn't get noticed. Our Krista Johnson, our executive assistant, has always taken the minutes on that farmland report, and I wanted to make sure I noted that. So with that, I would have a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Okay, thank you. I got a dual stereo. I appreciate that, Commissioner Cragen and Commissioner Perro. With that, we are adjourned.